This is Barry Tyker of the Oral History Project. Today is Monday, November 20th, 1995. I'm in my project office in the Red Gym.
Francis Hole, like a hole in the ground.
I'm with Dr. Francis Hole and Andrew Locke, and Andrew is going to be interviewing Dr. Hole about his career here at the university. Andrew?
Okay. We're very happy to have you with us here today. I have a number of questions for you, ranging from your birth until your career here. And as we were warming up before, you had a very interesting anecdote about you coming into this world, and perhaps you'd like to retell it.
Yeah, I was born at Muncie, Indiana, whereas my mother and father were living at Richmond. But I was born at Muncie because in Muncie there was a doctor, Walter C. Stevens, M.D., who was my uncle, and he had promised the extended family that he would deliver free of charge nieces and nephews as they might come along. Well, mother was expecting me to be born, and so she went up to Muncie for free delivery. And then very soon after that, I was brought back to Richmond, Indiana, where my father was professor of geology for 40 years. And then I actually succeeded him for 2 years.
Wow. So do you think that you had outstanding educational opportunities as a youth?
Yeah, I did. And I think it's important that I had that feeling. There was no question but that I would go to Earlham College after I got through the public school system at Richmond, which was an excellent public school system. It had a symphony orchestra, for example, and I played the violin in it. And Maddie, I forget Maddie's first name. Maddie was the director of symphony orchestras in high schools, and from Richmond, he went to Interlochen and founded the Interlochen summer orchestra camp. So I had good training in the public schools, and then, of course, Earlham was the only chance. I started in 1929 and graduated in 1933 from Earlham. It was in the depth of the Depression. Earlham was a good liberal arts college, and see, there was no, at the Depression, there was no thought that I could afford to go anywhere else, well, after all, we had the best college in the world, so we had this attitude, which is helpful to learning.
So, would you consider the Depression a significant event during your youth that perhaps, you know, influenced you, or?
Yeah, for example, during my freshman and sophomore years, I had a chance to work at the city library from 5 p.m. to 9 p.m. I was the only person in the building, and I would welcome in people who wanted to come in and read magazines and so forth, and during the wintertime, it would be people who wanted to come in and get warm because their little rooms were cold. I was paid $1 an evening, that is 25 cents an hour, for 4 hours. That meant I made $1 a day. And after 2 years, I had accumulated, as you might imagine, around $700 in a savings account. And I asked my uncle, another uncle, who was a professor of economics at Indiana University Extension, what I should do with this money. He said, well, put it in this very safe investment. So I did that, and the money disappeared. I want to know what should my attitude be? Should I bristle and fight somebody? And I asked Father, and Father shook his head. He said, well, Uncle Frank knows as much as anybody, and he's never seen a condition like this before. It's not anybody's fault. So then I turned off the worry button, and from then on, carried around glowing feelings and about where I'd worked and the people I'd met and so on. So in a sense, you see, that little anecdote, you see, shows how it affected people. $700 gone at $1 a day.
That must have been rough.
Well, you know, obviously I didn't need it because I was living at home. That was one of these economic measures. I kind of wanted to be at the dormitory on the campus, but Father said, oh, it costs a lot. So I was saving this money when always did gather money whenever possible and save it against the day when one might go to college or something like that somewhere else, which I actually did. But it shows the effect of the Depression.
Do you feel that your Quaker background has influenced you? maybe instilled values or something?
Oh, sure. Whatever religious tradition I would have been in, it seems it would have been true that at least I grew up taking religion rather seriously, a way of life, never questioned it, never had to rebel. The only rebellion, you see, that I had was to, instead of going into graduate work in geology, right after having a master's degree from Earlham in biology and geology, I went off and got a master's degree in French at Haverford College near Philadelphia. Now, that's what I call being rebellious. And then that enabled me to teach in Quaker private schools around Philadelphia, teach French and German, all kinds of stuff, and violin and music, from 1935 to 1934 to 1938. For 4 years I taught. Imagine getting a job in the Depression. Whereas some of my friends got car fare to the school where they, but that was all. I had a job that paid a real salary. So my Quaker background was one in which cast a blessing on the creation, on the universe, and so we were not committing a sin if we studied science. Whereas it was quite a struggle among people. You shouldn't be studying science if you're really going to be a religious person. That's secular. That says that God didn't create the universe.
You mentioned earlier that you followed in your father's footsteps in becoming a professor.
Yeah,
at Earlham.
Yeah, that was pretty unusual. That is, my mother died in 1939. At age 69, and their father was three years older than she. And of course, this is quite a blow to lose your partner, life partner. He taught an extra year in 1939-40. He'd been given special permission.
So do you feel
even in his 70s, so that he went on teaching. Then he died unexpectedly. Well, who knows? In August 22nd, I guess it was 1940. And the president of the college at the memorial service turned to me and said, "Would you take your father's classes next month? They begin in a month from now in September." I said, "What an honor!" I was halfway through the PhD, and of course, there's nothing better to get ready for oral exams in the PhD than to be teaching young people a whole series of courses in geology before going back to the university. It's an interesting, the whole community, the Richmond community and Earlham College community were quite touched that here this beloved professor, Daddy Holes, they call him, dies and in steps his son, up steps his son and takes over the classes without a hitch, you see, and a textbook salesman selling the introductory geology textbook by Chamberlain and Salisbury, who had gone from whatever universities they'd been at, including this university, to the University of Chicago. And here comes the book salesman and says, "I've always come to see your father every year, and here you are." So talk about kind of a tribal experience, which is rather unusual in our culture. People were really, this tribal experience, I think, is really rare. I did that for a year. And meanwhile, I was driving over to Indianapolis every weekend, courting Agnes, and so we were married in June at the end of that first year of teaching. And we told the president early on, you know, "We've got to go to the University of Wisconsin and get that PhD, because you can't have a professor around without a PhD for very long." He says, "You're right." So then we came up here, got the PhD done in 1943.
So the
came back to Earlham to teach.
With the reason of getting the PhD is what brought you to Wisconsin?
That's right, yeah. I applied, and with a record like mine, with a master's degree in French, when I applied to Caltech and to Cornell University, they wrote back saying they were uncertain as to whether I really was a scientific person. And I had this master's degree in French in the way. But the letter from Wisconsin was from Conrad Emmons, who's recently died in pushing into his 90s here in Madison. Con Emmons wrote and said, well, in the absence of the chair, I'm writing you to say we'd be very glad to have you come up here at Madison. We have a good geology department, we have a good soils department, we work together. He didn't say, oh, I see you got a master's degree, how horrible. We don't. It was this friend.
So they were pretty acceptive then.
Very acceptive. So
how did you first get interested in soils?
Well, of course, it would, since my father ran, which was not too common in those days, ran a field trip every summer for students at the college to national parks, some of which were quite new in the 20s. And we two boys, my brother and I, would on several occasions went, when my mother went along as a chaperone because there were women students, father, of course, was teaching the course, and then we two boys went along and had a little tent. So we were brought up in the witnessing teaching of geology and soils. My father did some soil survey work. So that was established. But I got off, as I say, on this track. My brother got interested in French at the college, and he actually ended up with a PhD in French, you see. And I was adoring and idolizing my brother, so I went off on that track. And then it dawned on me, hey, what am I doing? I really am a natural scientist. That's who I am. So then I had to go back and retool, and Wisconsin let me retool. F.T. Thwaites was my major professor.
Oh. So you received your PhD in geology and soil science?
With a minor in soil science.
Minor in soil sciences. Yeah. And how did it get to the point where you know, it's kind of a tradition once you get your PhD not to...
That's right.
Not to be a
I was most unusual that I was brought back. During the Depression, the soil survey of the Geological and Natural History Survey, of which the state is does well to be proud, that was allowed to lapse, funds cut and so forth. But as the end of the war, by this time I was a conscientious objector. The draft board in Richmond, Indiana had a problem. They had a fellow by the name of Francis Hole who said he was a conscientious objector with a Quaker background, and they didn't want to have on the record that anybody in Richmond, Indiana was of such a demented condition. They didn't like me walking around having just finished my PhD. I can understand their feeling. During a war which was to destroy Hitler, what, didn't I care? Wasn't I going to do anything about it that really mattered? Here I was teaching at the college. I got my call up to go to conscientious objector camps, in which I worked for a little over 2 years. Well, during that camp period, which is 1944-46, I got a letter from the University of Wisconsin saying, we're starting up the soil survey again. We want you to come and join this Geological Natural History Survey and be in charge of a small operation. We have a soil survey program on campus in cooperation with the Soil Conservation Service, which is a larger program. So it was soft money, it was extension, and they just had this need. And they said, well, he's just perfect for the job. He's got geology, he's got soil science, and a fair amount of biology. We need, that's the guy we want. So I got the letter in 45, and my wife and I had to decide, look, were we going to give up this kind of a dream that the community had that Daddy Hall would be succeeded by Daddy Two? We're going to give that up.
Was that a hard decision to come to?
It was hard, too, because in a sense, I was flaunting the divine, if you want to look at it that dramatically. The divine had chosen me to follow my father, and who was I to say, huh, I don't like the idea. But Agnes and I, decided we had better come to a new place, because already at the college, people would say to me, well, but you're mother did it this way, or your father did it that way. And so if I'd had a battery of psychiatrists to see me through this, I think it would have worked. But having a psychiatrist around was worse than death in those days. You just never went to a psychiatrist because that would show you were crazy.
What do you remember most about the environment on campus in your earlier days here?
Well, it was a very friendly campus. 10,000 students, which after Earlham College, which were 500 or 600 in the Depression, that was enormous, 10,000.
Yeah.
And on the campus, as I was walking across, I met Merritt Y. Hughes, chairman of the English department. And Merritt Y. Hughes said, he was in the little Quaker meeting, and he said, "Francis, it's good to see you." That professor, head of the would stop and talk to me. I thought, what kind of a university is this? It's so friendly. And I go to the Quaker meeting on Sunday, and there's Merritt Y. Hughes and a number of other people from the university. It was friendliness. The soil survey division was going full blast, and there was a feeling of we're after the Second World War. We're doing important stuff. We've got a wonderful team here. There was this university seemed to function as if it were a small college, although it had the numbers of a university. The goodwill and cooperation. It wasn't turf guarding, all that. Well, later on, I spent 1 month as a visiting professor at the University of Arizona in Tucson, and there it was a young university. In new territory added to this country, and the turf guarding between departments was something terrific, and doors kept shut and so forth. So that was a good experience to make me sure that we have something special here, that we stand on the shoulders of people who cared. They not only were good in their specialty, but they cared.
Well, you've been here or associated to this university for a very long time, so you must have seen some physical changes in the
environment. Oh yeah, of course it gets crowded with buildings, and the university leaks down across University Avenue and goes into parts of the city, all these dormitories. It's pretty crowded, and the lab, the Lake Lab building down there. Beyond the yacht, beyond the boathouses and so forth.
Limnology.
Limnology, that's it, right, limnology. This Lake Mendota is one of the most studied lakes in the whole world. That building was put there partly to block any further thought of having a super street automobile traffic so that people from downtown and the university could go home to Shorewood. Along the shore. Now it's just a walkway, and partly because this building was put right in the way.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I once heard that they were going to put a parking lot in the bay out by the Union here. They were going to fill in the bay and put a parking lot there. Had you heard anything about that?
No, I don't. I don't remember that. The cornfield, which is from between Willow Drive and the vet hospitals, that cornfield, you know, was a very important research station. They pumped the water out of it because the water kept coming in from Lake Mendota, slowly seeping. So they to keep the level just right for best for corn, and so they knew the rainfall and the parts. They had a large flower pot, and it was a cornfield, so they could account for every drop of water and all this stuff, and the pounds of corn produced. And Reed Bryson, he had on the radio over the country a recording of corn growing at 2 o'clock in the afternoon on a sunny day. And so I remember across the country they'd say the weather, it's time for the weather. And by the way, it's a nice July day, good for growing corn at Madison, Wisconsin. Professor Reed Bryson, what do we got here? Well, we have the sound of corn growing. So they weren't about to put a parking lot when they had that kind of research going.
Okay. What influence and impact did the work Silent Spring have on you or the campus?
Well, it was the general impact was, hey, we've gone too far. This woman, Rachel Carson, is dying of cancer, says with her manner of death and with from her book, Silent Spring, wake up, wake up. You hate me for saying what I'm saying, but I'm telling you the truth, that we are fouling our nest. So it was a pretty important reminder. Look at what's going on now. It doesn't seem to have sunk in.
Do you think there were any other events that perhaps raised environmental consciousness, perhaps that problems were around? I mean, what was the attitude of many of your classmates and colleagues towards the environment?
I think the University of Wisconsin was fortunate to have people who were sensitive to the fragility of the environment. We had the Arboretum out there with John T. Curtis, chairman of that work. They're doing ecological work. He welcomed any of us. Come on board. That's a part of the friendliness of this campus. John Curtis said to me, you should be doing this, you should be doing that. He was egging us all on. And he died of cancer too, you see. So you see him walking across the campus in his last steps. We had our own Rachel Carson.
Wow. You were involved in soil sciences largely before it was widely recognized by most of academia. I mean, was it hard to convince people of the importance of studying?
Yeah, it looks ridiculous to study soil. There's quite a gap between human beings and the soil. And the idea of studying soil, the human race has this problem. For example, over in Russia, Vivi Dokuchayev was a man in the late, 1880, was he'd come into full renown as a soil scientist. So the Russian and the American soil scientists, when they finally got together, made a big push for recognition of the importance of soil science. But when Dokuchayev was in his prime in Russia, he wanted to have a division of government, the Soils Institute. And the authorities, the political authorities and all organizations said, well, then, you know, soil is not a subject. Besides, the farmers are right in touch with it. They know all about that. And it's just, it's just a farmer thing, managing this. So here these people were trying to say, but there's got to be a science if we're to manage it right. It deserves. The soil science department here was the first in the country. So named. So, you could. Nowadays, we would call it the Department of Pedology, but we're still afraid to do that because pedology is the study of geology, Department of Geology. Pedology is the study of that on which the foot rests, pedology. And we are pedologists. If we were to look at soil as a scientific entity, we would be pedologists and so forth. But we're afraid to do that. We still call it Department of Soil Science because we still want a budget. And the people in the legislature and in Washington, D.C., they had the same prejudices as the people they represent, which is that soil is not a subject. It's part of the landscape that you manage if you want to get something out of it.
But, so did the government interfere with the budget?
Well, and certainly the state legislature, when they wrote me, look, we're refinancing the soil survey of Wisconsin at the state level, that meant that there was plenty of money around, and they could even give it to something like soils, even though there was a national organization, Soil Conservation Service, which doesn't exist anymore because in Washington, just think it's time to kind of shuffle all these organizations and just say there isn't a Soil Conservation Society, any Soil Conservation Service anymore. We've done that. We've almost done that. Hans Jenny, who's my guru, he died in his early 90s, about four or five years ago. He was Swiss soil scientist, and he had his career first at the University of Missouri and then at Berkeley, California. In a sense, if anybody can be called a dean of soil science, Hans Jenny, J-E-N-N-Y, was that charming, charming man and impeccable in his statistics and the nicety with which he did all his research. He said there, he says in his, he wrote two books, which are the Jenny era, 1941, I think it is, he wrote one, Factors of Soil Formation. For the first time, he made it possible for people to study soil with some confidence that they were getting a statistical, meaningful set of figures. And then in 1980, when he was 80 years old, he produces the Soil Resource, Nature and Genesis, in which he lays out in very readable form, not only for specialists, his life work. And in that he says one place, well, there is something of a barrier between people and the soil. If some scientist in any specialty in science finds something that's really rather exciting, it gets into science right away, nature, it's immediately, and then it gets in headlines of the papers. I've been part of several occasions on which we soil scientists came up with something rather interesting. Not a boo, not a boo. Oh, there is an enormous barrier between us and the soil. I've got a little thing I do on the violin to illustrate that. So, what are we going to do?
Okay, well,
We have to keep on working in soil science, but the thing of it is, to free up an ordinary citizen ought to be able to stand on the soil, to walk across the soil and say, you are the ground of my being. And I appreciate that. Without you, there'd be no plants, there'd be no animals, we'd have nothing to eat, we wouldn't be here. If it was just bedrock, much as I like rocks, just bedrock from horizon to horizon, there wouldn't be any of the life forms that we know, including ourselves. There had to be soil first, and I've got a myth or two developed, because how are we going to get into people's consciousness that the soil is a part of the living room we live in? But we're going to have to. So I'll even use a myth to tell them how soil was formed.
Okay.
Right here. Okay.
Well, you see, the myth is this, that the Great Spirit was walking back and forth across the land before there was any soil on this planet, and was walking across beautiful granite. Granite is the main rock in the lands, as opposed to the dark rock that's underneath the oceans. The sunlight was sparkling, and the Great Spirit said to the granite, "Granite, had you ever thought about loosening up in your upper part?" Granite said, What'd you say? Loosen up in my upper part? That doesn't make any sense. That's suicide. I went through a lot. I was once liquid down underneath the mountains, and I went through a lot to get strong like I am. You're walking on me, you notice how strong I am. And you're asking me to be loosened upper part? If I got loosened my upper part, to blow away or wash away right into the ocean, it'd be a complete waste. And what have I been working for to be so durable? Anyhow, well, of course, the Great Spirit walked back and forth, and then, I don't know whether it was thousands of years later, it doesn't make any difference because there's plenty of time. The Great Spirit said, granted, I should have explained to you when I broached that subject of your loosening, possibly loosening in your upper part. I should explain that I'm making land plants. They have roots. Roots are like strings and threads, and they have to have something a kind of a spongy material that they can grow in to get their water and their nutrients. It can't get into you, granted. You're so absolutely solid. There's no getting into you. No water, no air, no root. And I'm making these plants, and I was just, well, we've got to have some soil. And the grant said, soil, roots, what are you talking about?
So the Great Spirit explained briefly what a plant is. Granite said, "You keep asking me to loosen up my upper part. Well, I tell you, I just cannot resolve that thing, because if I loosen up, I wash away, blow away." And the Great Spirit said, "What if we had a covenant between you, Granite, and the plants, and the plants? That's enough. Have a covenant between the two of you. The plants promise to hold you together if you're loosened up with their roots. Bind you together. And also the plants will grow up and make a canopy of leaves that'll catch the blows of the rain and the sleet and hail whenever it comes down. So you're protected like a mother hen protects her chicks under her wings." That's what the plants would do. Yeah, would you be willing to loosen up under those conditions? And the greats and Granite thought, ponder deeply as only Granite can ponder. And then finally said, I'll do it. It's risky. But for the sake of the great experiment with life, I'll do it. I'll sign the covenant. Where's that? Where do I sign it? And so it took a lot of persuasion for the Great Spirit to get Granite to yield. And all over, you'll notice, you try to find some bedrock to show to a class, you have a hard time, because the plants have been working so hard and making soil and protecting it. You notice that if the soil is exposed anywhere, weeds come in. All the plants, even the most beautiful rare plants and ordinary ones we call weeds, they come in. They take it very seriously, this business of protecting the soil. That's how we got soil, and that's why we're here. Because you know we eat things that are plants produce, and or animals from eating the plants.
Have you witnessed the campus environment change a lot, would you say? Change?
The campus?
Yeah, the environment, the trees, the shrubs.
Well, they do as best they can. They do.
I mean, you were speaking earlier of this cornfield.
Yeah, the cornfield has now been turned into a lake, a duck pond, with a path around it. Sometimes I take people down there with an auger, and we can pull out some of that wonderful peat. I think that there's this little Thoreau garden here at Johnson and Park Street. There is a certainly a live concern in some of this, the Institute for Environmental Studies that Reed Bryson and others put together. So I think there is an awareness, but you can never have too much awareness. So walking on the soil is a meditation which the Buddhists already know a lot about, taking a walking meditation. But I think aside from the Buddhist approach, we who are walkers on the earth owe it to ourselves to celebrate this miraculous entity called the soil.
What do you think your favorite area?
Oh, what am I doing?
How do you do that? No one's ever done this before. Knock on your microphone. There we go.
Okay.
What do you consider your favorite area on campus and why?
Well, I suppose the Arboretum.
I
did a lot of work out there with Dr. Curtis.
What about on campus?
On the campus itself.
Yeah.
I suppose Picnic Point, you could consider that base of Picnic Point, despite all those parking lots, where you can walk along Willow Drive and so forth, you can be at the contact between the body of water and the body of land.
What was Picnic Point like when you were younger?
Well, it was more remote from parking and all that. And it was, in other words, it was a bit wilder.
Okay. How has your work, articles, papers, lectures, influenced the health of the environment on campus and in Wisconsin? Do you feel you've raised kind of
one little thing that I got involved in is the campaign to have a state soil named. Out of the 50 soils in the state, in the country, 10 have gone to that effort, and that's a really difficult effort. I had no idea how difficult it was, but you see, I didn't go down to the legislature. I don't feel at home aggressively pushing myself on people. But that in some states, like the state of Kansas, opposite of mine, working with the Soil Conservation Service, finally got a state soil of Kansas recognized. But all I did was to start, when I would give general talks using my violin and puppets and whatnot, give a general talk on soils to an audience. I would... go ahead.
Would you say you generally addressed younger people or...
Well, the general program that I developed about soils that people would be glad to listen to for any age, pre-kindergarten, retirees like myself, or intergenerational groups at churches, for example, because no matter how much I shouted and sang and all this stuff, every age thought something was going on. The kids knew something was going on because the guy was prancing around and you never knew what was going to happen next. And the older people saw the depth and the profundity of it all and the joy of it all. But as I say, getting a state soil, the state soil was made real because people... They saw that it was going to be fun. They saw I was having fun, and teachers would take their sixth grade classes, fifth grade classes, seventh grade classes down to the hearings. Every bill has to have a hearing in the Senate and in the Assembly, and so the hearing room was filled with kids. Now the teachers, I didn't get those kids down there. They didn't. They made out petitions and signed petitions and sent them in, urging that there be a state soil. So that kind of pressure, the photographers from the newspapers were there, and here's a committee, a hearing committee of the great government of Wisconsin. And how does government work, children? Government works this way. Some people think that there should be the Dubuque silt loan should be the state soil. Mr. Hole here thinks that that the Antigo should be. So this government's going to decide that.
And what did they decide?
They decided, but it was a horrendous experience. They decided to have the Antigo silt loan, which I was the one that I was selling, pushing for. But you see, the kids of this state wanted to have a certain insect. What was it they were going to have? Maybe it was a monarch butterfly. Going to have an insect, state insect, but the legislature changed that to honeybee. Because the honeybee does something that means dollars and cents. So I was pushing for the Antigo silt loam. But because of the gap between human beings and the soil, there was not an early enough marshalling of the opponents of the Antigo silt loam in the state legislature to stop that. Because the people do not feel at home with the soil. They don't want to be bothered with it. It's dirty stuff anyway. So that I had that advantage of dealing with a subject, an entity, that people were shying away from. But once it got close to the time, then everybody had to say, I want that to be the Dubuque silt loam. It's in my territory, and Antigo is not. Besides, the Antigo is a dumb old soil in the north. They can't even grow jack pine. So you begin to get these mudslinging. They're beginning to throw.
Mudslinging. Yeah.
So I had to go and see this argument going on, which climaxed at a discussion, a argument in the Assembly
right at the end of the whole program. By the way, Fred Risser, first Tiny Krueger, who weighed 250 pounds, he's the one that noticed that I was giving talks here and there about there should be a state soil because the badger can't dig in an official soil. That's how it's done. You make a badger state animal, and then you don't give it a soil that's officially blessed for it. And a maple tree can't even root in an official tree. You got to. So Tiny Krueger pushed that. Then he retired before anything got going, and then the Democrat Risser picked it up and knew how to schedule things so that it. So that we weren't competing with the budget. When the budget comes up, then they take leave of their senses, and they just stop on anything. They take out their frustrations on. But so Risser was so clever; he got it so that the vote took place. Well, I was present at the last discussion in the assembly, and the Muck Growers Association wanted to be heard on. We're the Muck Growers Association. We think that the Suwamico muck should be the state soil. It produces tons and tons, truckloads of carrots. Ever hear of any such thing being produced on the Anticosti? Oh, no, no. Well, then they voted. You saw this scoreboard up there. Oh, they just barely missed getting to be the Suwamico muck. So it was quite a battle, but the Anticosti got through. So that kind of raised the awareness level.
Oh, yeah. I mean, how do you follow that up? Well, we're going to kind of change gears a little bit now,
okay.
If you don't mind.
No.
What do you feel will happen in the future in regard to the campus environment? Do you see change or, you know, status quo or...
Well, I hope, I just think, seems to me, it can expand, the campus can expand by having, like MATC has campuses at different places in the community. I suppose this campus could expand that way. I hope that it will not go into the Muir Woods. When the sociology building was allowed to go into the sacred Muir Woods, then it was almost... foregone that all the rest of the Muir Forest up there on Bascom Hill would be sacrosanct and would never be built in because it has the Cathedral of the Forest and it's really a part of the Arboretum. It's a steady place. Actually, I think that the Muir Woods should have a chain link fence around it so not just anybody. See, now anybody can walk and sit down, light up a cigarette, you can. Or say, oh, we over at our fraternity need to have some branches are rotting as a part of our Halloween exhibit. You see, it's not protected. And there would be an entryway, and you'd be charged to go in with a guide as much as if you went to a football game. And you would be, by that time, brainwashed to understand that seeing that forest and understanding it and walking and being hushed in that forest is as great an experience as going to a football game. In fact, might be considered greater. Football game, in a sense, might be considered a form of insanity compared to the experience that you'd pay the same amount for. So I would hope that that forest would be protected for scientists, poets, artists. Every poet should spend some time in there just sitting and writing.
I had an art class and we spent a lot of time there.
Yeah, so you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, it's very beautiful.
Yeah. Well, yeah, there certainly would go back to the minutes. I remember the faculty was going to have a meeting at which they would vote, in which a policy would be made concerning, this was after the fact of the building of the sociology department. I think when the sociology building was built, probably there was just the championing of the natural environment had not reached a vocal level. So the meeting I'm thinking of is when there would be something said about the Muir Woods, which would be a declaration of its sacredness, and it would not have the same fate as the woods where the sociology building is.
What about the new field house or the law school? Do you think they'll make any significant changes in the campus environment?
Well, I'm in a different I love this campus. I love the buildings, and I want the law school to have this beautiful thing. But I, another part of me knows that every square inch, every square foot that you take away from allowing the sun on a sunny day to flood this, the ground is a wound. Every time you cover that up, it's a wound. Of course, the soil will have its last laugh, because it'll be around for millions of years, well, it and its successors. And we have to work like dogs because to keep it. The soil is a slow motion ocean. As soon as a multi-million dollar highway is built, the soil goes to work to destroy it. And that's its job, is to destroy. And every building is crumbling. The upkeep of these buildings is fantastic because they're all turning into soil. Bascom Hall is turning into soil, and then they've got some kind of cement that would make that Madison sandstone act like it was a sandstone and not just sand. This is all going to turn. You can't look at anything that is not going to turn into soil. I'm going to turn into soil. This building is going to turn into soil unless they keep replacing it. This gym is being made a sacred place, so it's going to have to be replaced. But you kind of wonder, I was talking with a colleague this morning about how the libraries are filling up with journals, and their new journals every year being founded. How long can these libraries house tons and tons and tons of journals where all our knowledge is, and we want to look that up and see who said what in 1969 and so forth. And they got new ones. We're being asked, therefore, to build a forever expanding roof over all these materials. It just.
What is your opinion on the Monona Terrace project?
Well, I'm also, I can be on either side of that, but I happen to be with a group that was struggling to have it built when Frank Lloyd Wright was still alive, and we thought it was such a charming idea. And despite his personal life slippage, which you can call a slippage if you want to, that guy must have had a lot of uncertainties about himself to be so arrogant. He was a creative person, and so I wanted, and I hated to see the way it was stopped. It was no building higher than 12 feet 6 inches or something like that shall be. I mean, they stooped to anything. So now that, see, then it was the activists, the leftists that were for it. Now it's the rightists who are for it, I guess. And Paul Soglin's been in both positions. I can see that it's an invasion of the environment, but it's a beautiful invasion. So I'm still feeling positive about that, though I can argue on either side.
Earlier in the interview, you mentioned about visiting many of the national parks, perhaps when they were.
Yeah, that's when my father was leading these. The northern trip was to Yellowstone Park and Glacier Park, and the summer trip was to Grand Canyon, Meteor Crater, San Juan Mountains.
These places were all fairly new at this time.
Yeah. And then the Rangers were just such sweet guys, and they would say, come over after supper. They'd walk around where we were all camping when we first arrived. Come on over, we're going to have a meeting. And we'd sing songs together, and there was a talk about natural environment and so forth. But now I understand that a lot of the force, our police, trying to prevent all kinds of illegal things from going on this public land, which can now be ruined by abuse.
It's definitely happening in places like Yellowstone, where the cars are all just lined up, you know. And
where the what?
The cars are all lined up, waiting to get in, you know, pumping in.
Right now, at this moment.
Well, probably, because they've been closed for the last 3 days.
Right.
Well, it's even worse than that. In the Southwest, they're vandalizing the Anasazi ruins. Uh-huh. teenagers are taking sledgehammers and just for no reason at all,
just smashing,
the writings, you know, and people are still robbing the graves and the holy sites of the Anasazis and selling them to, profit.
During the course of this interview, you've mentioned a lot about people's personal feelings and attitudes, and how they can use their attitudes to like help them out or something. It seems like you've been in a lot of positions where your good attitude or just perhaps your charisma has.
In getting a state soil, why did they do that? Why did Risser? Why did Krueger? It's because my wife used to say, Francis, I turn on the TV, and during the publicity about the Antigo Silt Loam, just before the final vote, and there you are hamming it up on TV. You just lie back and you ham it up, and it's just fun. So when people see that somebody's having fun, they want to join in it. And they allow themselves to join in it. People from Wisconsin still remember when I was on playing the Antigo Silt Loam song on TV. Are you going to be there for that? Bring your violin. No, I'm just an amateur violin player. But it isn't that I'm a violin player or not a violin player. It's because I'm having fun. And we as a tribe, people of Wisconsin, are having fun, and the kids are having fun, and the adults are having fun. They're enjoying. Yeah, you see, you can, and I'm not, I see, I'm in a perfect position because I'm not trying to sell anything.
Yeah.
I'm not getting anything that's going to make, it's not an ego thing. It's to step back and say thank you to the soil. When I'm at a school, I'll say, look, when you're walking home and nobody's looking, why don't you just stop and say, thank you, soil. And maybe you'll hear the soil say, Becky, I've been waiting for 10,000 years for you to come. I talk stuff like that, and they just love it. They eat it up. Well, people want to have they want to loosen up themselves, and they're looking for ways to do that. And the Pied Pipers, will be have plenty of people following him.
You once said, as you discover the soil, you will discover yourself.
George Vukele, that little article that he got in Isthmus,
yeah,
says
right.
that. Yeah, well, of course, that's true. As we identify with beauty and miracle of the planet Earth floating out in this bitter cold space, we release. Then we find out about ourselves. Within us, there's this explorer, this child that has not been squelched completely. I think learning is enjoyment, and life is enjoyment. That's what it's for. And we academicians might as well practice enjoyment in our own as we do our own activities. This is an entirely different kind of enjoyment from the stuff that Hollywood and Coca-Cola are selling. It really tickles me that the Amish in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, are doing so well and so well financially and so modestly. They certainly don't follow the secular world, and look at all that they've got. As far as I can see, it's not a perfect society, but they've got happiness, real joy.
Are there any of your works in particular that you'd like to talk about? Is there anything that you have done that stands out in your mind as important?
Well, Dr. Medler was a an entomologist here on campus. If he's still alive, and I hope he is, he's in Hawaii. He retired to Hawaii. He's the one who came to me one day, the entomologist, and said, "Francis, I wish you'd be studying the soil and the prairie remnants and seeing what the Western mound building ant is doing to the soil. It builds mounds like a small tree stump. What is that? What is its role in the development of the prairie soil?" He didn't have to come and ask me to do that, but he says, "I study the insects. We'll get a vacuum cleaner and we'll suck up all the ants in a colony and count them as you go past the counter." So we're studying the insects. Our job is not to study the soil, but together the two of us could put our studies together. And so I think the study of the ant mounds has been a, thanks to his suggestion, has been an important thing in my life.
What did you learn from that?
Well, the ant, that particular ant, the Western Mound Building ant, builds colonies. The female, after a nuptial flight, comes down, finds a spot on the prairie where there's not an ant mound now. Starts a new one where there is no smell of recent activity by some other ant queen. And for 12 years, she lays eggs. That's our big assignment. So she's got all these hundreds and thousands of workers for 12 years. And then she wears out and dies and doesn't lay any more eggs. And then so there's the ant colony disappears and the thing begins to collapse back. Now that's been happening at every point on the prairie for some 6,000 years or more. The ants come down and they always put a place where the ant mound has collapsed so many years ago that you really can't tell, just can't smell it anymore. So really what has been happening is we're used to looking at alluvial soils down in the valleys. And we, before Europeans and Asiatics and whatnot came, those rivers, those streams would flood, of course, in very rainy periods, and carry some of the best soil from the ridgetops, not in unusual amounts, but in small amounts over the centuries, and lay down a layer of black, beautiful soil. Black earth is named after such soil. But on the prairie, way up on the ridgetop, way off from floodwaters, the ants have been laying a black layer of soil, not as one blanket, but as a spot here, a spot here, a spot here. But when you put all the spots together, you get the same kind of result, in a way, that was down in the valley where the mechanism was different. It was water carrying very fine humus-rich soil and laying out down sheets of it, like the Nile River did. That's one way to do it. But the other way is to have a colony that takes charge of a patch for 12 years and then brings in nutrients, enriches that. The nutrient content of the mound is much higher. The soil there is higher than the surrounding because their job is to drain the land, the prairie flowers and the plants from all around for 3 meters out from each mound. I never realized that before until I studied these mounds. They're doing the same thing. They're putting a blanket of black, good, fertile soil over the landscape. And they're churning, they're plowing the soil. I'll go down and bring up this clay bee horizon, put it on top. And then all the plant roots, living and dying, turn that bee horizon into a black soil. So, you know, there's some places it's 2 feet of black soil up on the ridgetop.
Wow. Any other important points you'd like to add?
I don't think of any.
Don't think of any? I hear you're going to play your violin for us.
Well, I'll be glad to do that.
Okay, let's.